She leant over him and kissed him. Then she snuggled down on the pillow beside him, careful not to jostle his injuries.
"If that is what you want, then we will have to start making the arrangements," she suggested.
"I have already done so," he confessed. "There is an excellent private clinic just outside Malaga. I have a friend at the bank's head office in Malaga who will find us a flat and a maid. I have arranged a transfer to the head office so that I will be with you when the baby is born."
"It sounds so exciting," she agreed.
"And if you get to choose where the baby is to be born, then I choose where we marry when we eventually can. That's fair, isn't it?" He smiled. "Yes, that is fair. I want to be married at Feltefrieden. There is an old slave church on the estate built 150 years ago. My grandmother, Nana, had it completely restored and renovated for my brother Gary's wedding. It's exquisite, and Nana filled it with flowers for Gary and Holly. I will have arum lilies. Some people believe that they are unlucky, but they are my favourite flowers and I'm not superstitious, or not much anyway." Patiently he let her ramble on, occasionally murmuring encouragement, awaiting the precise moment for his next revelation. And she gave him the opening.
"But we are cutting things a little fine, Ramon, darling. I mean, Nana will want at least 6 weeks to make all the arrangements, and by then I'm going to be the size of a house. They'll play the baby elephant walk as I come down the aisle."
"No, Bella," he contradicted her. "At your wedding you will be slim and beautiful, because you will no longer be pregnant." She sat bolt upright on the bed.
What are you trying to tell me, Ramon? Something has happened, hasn't it?"
"Yes, you are right. There is bad news, I'm afraid. I have heard from Natalie. She is still in Florida. She is being obstinate, and there are legal delays."
"Oh, Ramon."
"I am as unhappy as you are about it. If there was anything I could do, believe me, I would do it."
"I hate her," she whispered.
"Yes, sometimes I feel that way, but truly it is not a disaster, only an inconvenience at the most. We will still be married, and you will still have your little slave church and your arum lilies. It is just that our son will be born before that happens."
"Promise me, Ramon, swear it to me, that we will be married as soon as you are free."
"I swear it to you." She settled down beside him, cradling her head on his good shoulder, hiding her face so that he could not guess how disappointed she truly was.
"I hate her, but I love you," she said,
and Ramon gave a grim little smile of satisfaction that she could not see. He was confined to the flat by his wound for another week, and there was time to talk. She told Ramon about Michael and was flattered by the interest he showed in her brother. She expanded on Michael's virtues and on their special relationship. Ramon listened and drew her out gently. He was so easy to talk to. She looked upon him as an extension of herself. She found herself going on to tell him about the rest of her family, about what lay behind the public mask that they as a group presented to the world, about their secrets and their weaknesses and their scandals, about Shaza and Tara's divorce. She even told him about the dark suspicion that Nana had once given birth to a bastard son in the wild southern deserts of Africa. "Of course, nobody has ever proved it. I don't think anybody would dare. Nana is a formidable force," she laughed. "And that is understating the fact. However, there was definitely some very fishy business back there in the 1920s. In the end, Ramon brought the conversation back to Michael. "If he's here in London, why haven't you introduced us? Are you ashamed of me?"
"Oh, may I? May I bring him around here, Ramon? I've told him a little bit about you, about us. I know he'd love to meet you, and I'm sure you'll like him. He's the only truly sweet and good Courtney. The rest of us..." She rolled her eyes comically.
Michael arrived with a bottle of his father's burgundy under his arm. "I thought of bringing flowers," he explained, "but then I decided to get something useful instead." He and Ramon scrutinized each other carefully as they shook hands. Isabella watched them anxiously, willing them to like each other. "How are your ribs?" Michael asked. Isabella had told him that Ramon had taken a toss from his horse and broken 3 ribs. "Your sister is holding me prisoner. There is nothing wrong with me. Nothing that a glass of that excellent burgundy won't cure." Ramon displayed that rare warmth and special charm of his, which was irresistible. Isabella felt quite giddy with relief. Her two most favourite and important people were going to like each other. She took the burgundy through to the kitchen to find a corkscrew. When she returned with the open bottle and two glasses, Michael was settled in the chair beside the bed, and they were already engrossed in conversation. "We get the airmail edition of your paper, the Golden City Mail, at the bank," Ramon was telling him. "I particularly like your financial and economic coverage."
"Oh, you're in banking," Michael nodded.
"Bella didn't tell me that." "Merchant banking. We specialize in sub-Saharan Africa." And they were away at a conversational gallop. Bella kicked off her flat shoes, rolled up the bottoms of her blue jeans, and perched up on the bed beside Ramon. Although she took no part in the conversation, she listened avidly. She had no idea that Ramon had such a grasp of African facts and realities, such a deep knowledge of the personalities and places and events which made up the rich and fascinating mosaic of her native land. Compared to this discussion, all her previous conversations with him had been shallow and trivial. Listening to the two of them, she learnt new facts and heard ideas expressed that were totally fresh to her. Michael was obviously as impressed as she was. His pleasure at finding a challenging and stimulating intellect on which to try out his own interpretations and beliefs was evident. It was after midnight. The original bottle of wine and another that Isabella had dug out of her tiny stock in the kitchen were empty. The bedroom was thick with the smoke of Michael's camels before she looked at her watch and exclaimed, "You were invited for one drink, Mickey, and Ramon's an invalid. Away with you now." She went to fetch his overcoat. While she helped him into it, Ramon said softly from the bed, "If you were doing a series on the political exiles, it wouldn't be complete without one on Raleigh Tabaka." Michael laughed ruefully. "I'd give my chance of salvation for a crack at Tabaka, the mystery man. It just ain't possible, as old Rudyard put it. If you know the track of the morning mist, then you know where his pickets are." "I've met him in the line of duty at the bank. We keep tabs on all the players. I might be able to arrange for you to meet him," Ramon told him. And Michael froze and stared at him with one arm in the sleeve of his coat. "I've been trying to get hold of him for 5 years," he said. "If you could." "Call me tomorrow around lunchtime," Ramon told him. "I'll see what I can do." At the door, Michael kissed Isabella. "I take it you are not coming home tonight."
"This is home," she hugged him. "My temporary residence at Cadogan Square was just to impress you. But I don't have to do that any longer."
"He's a knockout, your Ramon," Michael said. And she felt a sudden shocking stab of jealousy, as though another woman had challenged her for Ramon's affection. She tried to suppress it. It was the only ugly feeling she had ever harboured towards Mickey. But the pain persisted as she went back to the bedroom and deepened again as Ramon said, "I like him. Your brother is one of the superior beings. They are rare enough." She felt ashamed of her unkind feelings towards Mickey. How could she harbour the slightest doubt that Ramon was her man, a natural man? She knew that he liked Michael only for his charm and fine intellect, and because he was her brother. And yet that dirty, sneaking feeling persisted. She stooped over the bed and kissed Ramon with a passion that surprised even her. After the first moment of shock, his mouth opened and their tongues slithered and rolled around each other, slippery as mating eels. She broke away at last and looked up at him. "You swan around Europe for weeks on end, leaving me pining, and when you do come home you lie around in bed hogging food and sleeping," she accused him in a husky voice, tight with her need for him, "and never a thought for the maid or the nurse. Well, Master Ramon, I'm here to tell you it's payday, and I've come to collect." "I'll need some help," he warned her. "You just lie still. Don't do a thing. Nurse's orders. We'll take care of the details." She drew back the bed sheets and reached down under them, and her voice was a languorous coo. "We'll take care of things. He and I. You keep out of it." She straddled him gently, taking care not to touch his bandaged chest. As she sank down on top of him, she saw her own deep need reflected in the green mirror of his eyes, and felt all her doubts evaporate. He belonged to her, and to her alone. Afterwards she lay on his good side, close and secure and happy, and they talked drowsily, hovering on the edge of sleep in the darkness. When he mentioned Michael again, she felt a twinge of remorse at her earlier doubts. She was so relaxed, so much off guard, and she trusted Ramon as she did herself. She wanted to explain and share it with him.
Poor Mickey. I never suspected the agony he had to endure all these years. I am closer to him than any person in the world, and yet even I did not know about it. A few days ago I found out quite by accident that he's a practicing homosexual. The words were out before she could stop them, and suddenly she was appalled by what she had done. Mickey had trusted her, and she shivered, waiting for some reaction from Ramon. However, it was not what she had expected.
Yes, he agreed calmly. I knew that. There are some indications which are unmistakable. I knew it within the first half hour.
She felt a rush of relief. Ramon had known, so there was no betrayal on her part. You are not repelled by it?
No, not at all, Ramon answered. Many of them are creative and intelligent and productive people.
Yes, Mickey is like that, she agreed eagerly. I was shocked at first, but now it means little to me. He's still my darling brother. However, I do worry about him being caught up in a criminal prosecution.
Oh, I don't think there's much chance of that.
Society has accepted... Oh, you don't understand, Ramon. Michael likes black boys, and he lives in South Africa.
Yes, Ramon agreed thoughtfully. That could present some problems.
Michael phoned the flat from a pay booth in Fleet Street a little before noon, and Ramon answered on the second ring. The news is good, Ramon assured him. Raleigh Tabaka is in London, and he knows of you. Did you write a series of newspaper articles back in 1960 under the title Rage?
Yes, a series of six for the Mail. It got the paper banned by the security police.
Tabaka read them and liked them. He has agreed to meet you.
My God, Ramon, I can't tell you how grateful I am.
This is the most marvellous break. Ramon cut off his thanks.
He'll meet you this evening, but he has laid down some conditions.
Anything, Michael agreed quickly.
You are to come to the meeting alone. No weapons, of course, and no tape recorder or camera. He does not want his voice or appearance on record. There is a pub in Shepherd's Bush, he gave Michael the address. Be there at 7 this evening. Carry a bunch of flowers, carnations. Someone will meet and take you to the rendezvous.
Right, I've got that.
One other condition. Tabaka wants to read all your copy on the interview before you print it.
Michael was silent for a slow count of 5. The request contravened all his journalistic principles. It amounted to a form of censorship and cast a slur on his professional ethics. However, the price was an interview with one of the most wanted men in Africa.
All right, he agreed heavily. I'll give him first read.
And then his tone brightened.
I owe you a favour, Ramon. I'll come around and tell you all about it tomorrow evening.
Oh, don't forget the bottle of wine.
Michael rushed back to Cadogan Square. As soon as he reached the telephone, he cancelled all the rest of the day's appointments and then settled down to plan his strategy for the interview. His questions had to be searching, but not so barbed as to cool Tabaka's cooperative mood. He had to be sincere and sympathetic and yet at the same time severe, for he was dealing with a man who had deliberately chosen the path of violence and bloodshed. To achieve credibility, his questions must be balanced and neutral, and at the same time designed to draw the man out. In particular, he did not want a mere recital of all the radical slogans and revolutionary jargon.
The term terrorist is generally applied to a person who, for reasons of political coercion, commits an act of violence on a target of a non-military nature during which there is a high probability of injury or death being inflicted on innocent bystanders. Do you accept that definition? And if so, does the label terrorist apply to Konte Wisizwe?
He worked that out as his first question, and lit another camel as he studied it.
Good.
That was what you call jumping straight in with both feet, but perhaps it needed a little honing and polishing. He worked on steadily, and by 5:30 he had prepared 20 questions that satisfied him. He made himself a smoked salmon sandwich and drank a bottle of Guinness while he reviewed and rehearsed his script.
Then he shrugged on his overcoat, armed himself with a bunch of carnations which he had bought at the corner store. It was drizzling rain. He flagged down a taxi in Sloane Street.